Thank you very much, Richard. Our last reader this evening is Ivan Doig. Judy and I, my wife Judy is here. Wave, Judy. Didn't get to. We moved to this place in 1971, and we were kind of funny folks anyway. I guess when we moved here, we'd moved from the city, and then in 1976 we really got funny and we opened a bookstore in Enterprise, that was kind of, you know, there were 2,000 people in town and 7,000 people in the county, and we opened a bookstore anyway. And it was I didn't remember, Ivan, but House of Sky is 1978, and that's when we met. You don't remember because I was in a long line of booksellers getting a book signed by you, and you inscribed it to me so that I couldn't resell it in the store. This was his first book. He doesn't have to worry about that now, see. But and then, interestingly enough, years later, Kate Joost, who was one of our fellows and lived here this winter, went off to the same show, the Booksellers Association show this year, and she came back with Ivan's new book, Hard Earth. And she said, here, read this, Rich. And so we were doing the planning for Winter Fish Trap at the time, and I started reading Hard Earth, and Hard Earth, which is Ivan's account of really the reconstruction of the first years of his life through the letters, the correspondence of his mother and his uncle, who was in the Pacific at the time. And so I wrote him a letter and I said, Ivan, if you're ever going to come to Fish Trap, this is a good year for you. Because we'd already been talking about the World War II theme, and I told him that Richard White was going to be here and that Alvin was going to be here, and he wrote back and said, or called back and said, I'll come. And we're extremely delighted that you're here, Ivan, and give him a big welcome. And
well, thanks very much, Rich. As the late show of the day's schedule here, I wanted to take a moment to say what a pleasure it has been to see the performances today. Everybody not only grown up, but very craftsmanlike about what they've done. Readers tonight, Sandra and Richard Garcia, terrific company to be in. And this morning's panel of Alvin, Gene, Harold, and Valerie. And the stimulation this afternoon of getting to hear Richard White's intellectual performance. Those of us in the West know by now that we don't always have history on our side, but with Richard, by God, we've got it in our custody. Hard Earth, as Rich stole most of my lines of my introduction here, grew out of a packet of letters, old airmail ones, from the last half year of World War II. They and the book begin in Montana, in Arizona, where my father took work in a defense plant. And we lived in the Alzona Park Defense Housing Project on the outskirts of Phoenix. And if you who know Phoenix, it's out near the Carl Hayden High School, a howling slum area these days. We'd left Montana to see if the milder winter in Arizona might help my mother's perilous health, her lifelong asthma. In this House of Sky, my first book, my first attempt to write about the people I grew up with, I wrote that memory is the near neighborhood of dream. This new book seemed to want to dance itself along those brain wall edges, and so I let it. A couple of quick things to tell you before letting the words talk for themselves. My mother's name was Bernita, and she was writing these letters to her youngest brother, Wally, who was on a destroyer in the South Pacific in the battle for Okinawa and a lot of other combat. And these are sections from the opening chapter of Hard Earth. The book opens with a postmark, Phoenix, Arizona, February 4, 1945. Dear Wally, I shouldn't even be writing you my troubles, but I have to spill over to someone. I'd just like to have you around so I could put my head on your shoulder and cry. It is going on 1, and we haven't had dinner yet. Charlie is resting. I thought the rest would do him more good than eating. Ivan is out in the backyard building roads. He had a foxhole dug you could bury a cow in. In that last winter of the war, she knew to use point-blank ink. Nothing is ever crossed out, never a P.S. The heart-quick line still as distinct as the day of the postmark, her fountain pen instinctively refusing the fade of time. Among the little I have had of her is that pen. Incised into the demure barrel of it, my father must have birthed her a couple of weeks' worth of his cowhand wages, and this gesture rests her maiden name. Readily enough, then, I can make out the hand at the page, the swift scritch of her letters racing down onto paper for Wally, someone to know. But all else of her, this woman there earmarking a war-striped airmail envelope with the return address of Mrs. Charles Doig, until now has been only farthest childscapes, half-remembering, thinned by so many years since. I had given up ever trying to uncurtain my mother. Now her pages begin her. I have to spill over to someone. Upward from her held pen. At last she is back again. Aluminum and Arizona, in their wartime tryst, produced Alzona Park, the defense workers' housing project, which had been feeling my shovel ever since my parents and I landed there. I knew, with the full mania of a 5-year-old, that the project's barren backyards necessitated my toy truck roads for strafing, bombing. World War II had a lot of destruction to be played at yet. I was lonesome for my foxhole, though. By a turn of events you just couldn't foresee in desert warfare, it had been put out of service by rain. My mother made me fill the dirt back into the brimming crater lest somebody underestimate it as a puddle and go in up to the neck. Spies, saboteurs, the kind of subversive traffic you get in backyards, seemed to me to deserve precisely such a ducking. But my mother stood firm on foxholelessness. I suppose she had in mind our standing with our Alzonan barracks neighbors, who, if she would just trust my reports, all the more justified a foxhole. Hunker in there, peeking over the earth rim, and see what they turned into. Housewife snipers in the 200 building, be fought off with a pretend rifle. A long 300 building, a sudden Japanese battleship. The foxhole now needing to be a gun battery on the destroyer USS Alt. Blazing away at those fiends threatening our aircraft carriers, holding them off till down in the torpedo room, Wally. February 17, 1986. 4 fingers of flame thrust toward the snowfields of Mount Baldy and extinguish into echo. Stiffly working their rifle bolts to reload, the veterans of foreign wars honor guard aims and lets fire again, the combined muzzle flash flexing bright another instant. Then a last volley, and the honor guard dissolves into World War II oldsters, clutching at their campaign caps in the cemetery wind. Ceremonially, Wally Ringer's chapter of life was now over that wind-ridden afternoon. But in the family plot of time, not nearly done with. Can that be what this brother of my mother had in mind with the letters? Sensing the carrying power of that ink as a way to go on? That by making me heir to the lost side of my past, to my mother's own communiques of time and place, doing to her what they did, he would find a kind of lastingness too. At the moment, I only knew I was the most grudging of pallbearers, gritting against the shiver, more than windborne, of having come back where I'd promised myself not to. To hear where all the compartments of my earliest self rode together on me. Nephew, son, grandson, native of this valley, economic refugee from it, ranch kid, town nomad, only child awash in family attention, indrawn half orphan, chambered as a goddamn nautilus. 3 times before, I watched a saga of my family echo into the earth here, and in the glide of years since, convinced myself I was safely done with Montana burials. Those voices of the heart held no more to tell, I'd thought. Wally's in particular, I no longer gave ear to, for we had ended up somewhere between quibble and quarrel forever, as Quicksilver Uncle and I. But before any of this, before the gnarl and our family history that brought me back and back to that wintry cemetery, he was a sailor on the Alt. I am feeling pretty good, much better than any time so far since I've been down here, my mother's hand again. Charlie is the one that isn't well. His stomach bothers him all the time. He is so thin. A few of the letters in the packet duffled home from the Pacific are blurry from water stains. But this first one, by my mother to her sailor brother, is all too clear that we have traded predicament in Montana for predicament in Arizona. My parents and my father's sister Anna and her husband Joe and the 5-year-old dirt mover that was me had thrown what we had into a Ford coupe and pinballed our way down through the West 1,050 miles. Ration books straining from gas station along U.S. 89, me most of the time intrepidly shelved crosswise in the rear window, till we rolled to a halt in Phoenix the night before Thanksgiving of 1944. The next Monday, my father and Joe latched on as Aluminum Company of America factory hands, and our great sunward swerve settled into Alzona Park orbit. Unit 119B, where the 5 of us crammed in, consisted of a few cubicles of brown composition board, bare floors, windows howlingly curtainless until my mother could stand it no longer and hung some dime store chintz. Along with 5,500 other Alzonans, we were war loyally putting up with packing crate living conditions, but pulling in money hand over fist. My father and Joe drawing fat hourly wages at the aluminum plant, hourly, for guys who counted themselves lucky to make any money by the month in Montana ranch work. Surely this, the state of Arizona, humming and buzzing with defense plants and military bases installed for the war, this must be the craved new world, the shores of Social Security and the sugar trees of overtime? True. A product of defense work wasn't as indubitable as a sheep or a cow. Aluminum screeched through the cutting area where Dad and Joe worked, and a half mile of factory later was shunted out as bomber wings, but all in between was secret. For the 119B batch of us to try to figure out the alchemy, my father smuggled out down his pant leg a what's-it from the wing plant. I remember the thing as about the size of the business end of a branding iron, the approximate shape of a flying V, pale as ice and almost weightless, so light to hold it was a little spooky. "I'll bet you can't tell me what this is," Dad challenged as he plunked down the contraband piece of metal to wow my mother and Anna and me, and for that matter, his brother-in-law, Joe. Actually, my father had no more idea than any of the rest of us what the mystifying gizmo was. But it must have done something supportive in the wing of a bombing plane. Like light, time is both particle and wave. Even as that far winter of our lives traced itself as a single Arizona amplitude of season along the collective date line of memory, simultaneously it was stippling all through us in instants distinct as the burn of sparks. Out of those particles, those waves, this deliberate dream. The heavy rain that Christmas Eve was contradicting my mother's notion of what both Christmas and Phoenix ought to be. She was trying to work the mood to death, baking an army of cookies and rapidly wrapping Anna and Joe's presents, filmy kerchief for her, carton of cigarettes for him. Well, they were out visiting with friends they knew from Montana. And of course, the weather was keeping me inside, which was to say, in her hair, until she put me to crayoning a festive message to my grandmother. I came up with, "Merry Christmas, Grandma," in the countless fonts of my printed handwriting, and devoted the rest of the page to dive bombers blowing up everything in sight. Right on time, the outside door rattles open by my father's inevitable approximate whistling of "The Squaws Along the Yukon." Doesn't... doesn't follow on in. Instead, all of a sudden, he is in the kitchen with us, checking us over with his sheep counting look, even though we can only tally up to 2. Puts his lunch box down, goes to the silverware drawer, takes out a table knife, heads back to the front room where he jams the blade into the crack under the doorway casing so that the knife snugs the door unopenable. Whatever this is about, Anna and Joe are in for a surprise when they come home. My father zips back into the kitchen, pours himself a cup from the constant coffee pot, begins his news ever so casually, as he likes to do. "Did you happen to hear? I have only one fact in me, that it's about to be Christmas, and my mother, but 2, that it's about to be Christmas, and we are an interplanetary distance from anybody and anywhere we know. And so, my father's bulletin arrives spectacularly fresh. Leave it to him. He has pried it out of one of the aluminum plant gate guards who are giving everybody a going over at tonight's change of shifts, making the entire work gang shuffle through in single file so their security badges could be hawkishly inspected. "A whole hell of a bunch of German prisoners got away," is the report my father brings. The great breakout at the Papago Park prisoner of war camp had been engineered by U-boat men, tunnel visioned in the most effective sense. Somehow, they dug through a couple of feet of hard pan a day for the past 3 months, and tonight, 25 of them have moled out to freedom under the cover of ruckus set up by their comrades. My father tells us they're watching for the buggers everywhere, including now 119B. "What's next in the stampede?" murmurs my mother, simply in commentary of German POWs added to the rest of the deluge out there. Tonight she wouldn't be surprised if the moon itself came squashing down on Phoenix. Meanwhile, I am scared, flabbergasted, and inspired. A tunnel! A foxhole is nothing compared to that. Tomorrow will not be too soon for me to start my sandhog future beneath Salzona Park. Huns at the door of Phoenix don't faze my father, at least with a case knife jamming the door. He kids my mother about the Gluns and Zettels on her side of the family. "Just remember, Bernita, the MPs come around here. You're not related to those sauerkraut cousins of yours back in Wisconsin." What? What? I'd done my teething on the war. Could never remember when the grown-ups were not inveighing against Japs and Krauts. And now, "Mama, are we Germans?" My mother shoots my father, "And now look what you've started, look." "We're pedigreed Scotch," he assures me, but can't resist adding, "Even you and Mama, you both caught it from me." I am determined to get this matter of breed straight. "How did we catch it?" My father gives the handsome, jaunty grin off their honeymoon photographs on Grass Mountain. "It got pretty contagious there for a while." Naturally, I want to follow up on that. But my mother, business to do with cookies and wrapping paper, pokes another look at my father. "Charlie, do you figure you're about done storing him up?" "I guess maybe so," he acknowledges as he studies her. "Now what can I do about you?" All at once, he says, so soberly it breaks on the air as a kind of plea, "Merry damn Christmas, Bernita." Realization lifts her upper lip in the middle, her index of surprise. She honestly hasn't known how much her mood has been showing. She's at a loss. "Charlie, I only..." She hunches her shoulders a little, smallest shrug, but on it ride all the distances of this Christmas. Not only is my mother 1,000 miles separate from her own mother and father, they have separated from each other. My grandmother is cooking on a ranch in one part of Montana. My grandfather is in parts unknown. Bounced like dice against the war's longitudes and latitudes, Wally is somewhere in the Pacific theater of combat. My army Uncle Paul is in Australia. Here we are in aluminized Arizona and Alzona. This sunward leap of ours has been my father's doing for my mother's sake. More and more spooked by her asthma battles in the isolation of the Montana ranch, he flung the place away, piloted us out of Montana on war ball tires and waning ration books, recast himself from ranch man into aluminum worker. He has desperately done what he thought there was to do, made the move to Arizona for the sake of health, for her sake. But he can see the immense journey unraveling here on the snag of Christmas, homesickness, out of placeness. And now he is looking the plea to her, everything gathered in his eyes, pulling the square lines of his face tight. Fuss about her health has always put a crowbar in my mother's spine. Does again now. She straightens up as if shedding this hard year. She tells my father all the truth she has at the moment. I'll try to get over this, Charlie. She takes a breath as big as she is, not an asthma gas, but just fuel for what she needs to put across to him about her isolation amid a city full of strangers, how she misses everything about Montana there is to miss. It's going to take some trying, she lets him know. Invisible in plain sight at the kitchen table, crayoned combat forgotten on the tablet paper in front of me, I watch back and forth at these gods of my world in their confusion. At last, my father nods to my mother and says as though something has been settled. That's all we can any of us do, Bernita, is try. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks very much.